It's my great pleasure to start the year of events here at Many Rivers off right with our own Jim Wilson. Jim has been a poet for decades, published in a number of different venues, including magazines and books. He has contributed in many ways to both as a co-founder to this store, but also as a Buddhist teacher in the past, and we are delighted to have him here with us tonight to share his words, the words that he treasures from others. And thank you so much for doing this event.
Thank you. It's the last 00 year. So 2009.
Triple zero?
Well,
2009.
Oh. Oh, no, that would be double.
So I think it's double. Anyway, thank you very much for coming tonight. So the theme tonight is called Words Like Clay. The poems I'm going to be reading today are all in specific forms. And my relationship, I do write free verse. In fact, there's a volume of free verse on the table there. But when I write formed verse, my feeling is that what I'm doing with words is similar to what potters do with clay. You know, they'll take clay and then they'll form it into a teacup or form it into a plate. And so the challenge of writing in a specific form is to take the stream of words, you know, the raw stream of words, and sort of shape it into a specific form. So that's what I'm going to be, you know, reading tonight, you know, like that kind of poetry. Like, and I'm going to encourage people to ask questions or make comments and have a conversation here. It's a nice small group, and I like to keep it informal, so feel free. I'm going to start off with haiku. And all of these that I'm reading are from my latest collection called Crossing the Golden Gate Bridge. All the haiku in this volume are for the winter season, all of them. And what I like to do with haiku is to link them together in series. Reading a single haiku is a wonderful thing, but I also like to connect them, you know, like into related strings. I got that idea that the Japanese do that with their tanka, you know, like which that's another form that I'll get to, but going back to the earliest collections, they would take tanka and they would put them in a series that are thematically connected, like tanka on love or tanka on spring, and you can actually read them in a series, and they flow. Like the opening section of the oldest collection, which is called Kokinshu, starts with the spring season, so it's poems on spring, and it actually begins with the very late winter. Like, and then it moves into, you know, very early spring scenes, like with plum blossoms, you know, like, and then the whole sequence moves through the entire spring season, and then at the end you're almost into summer, you know, like so. So these are winter haiku, and specifically for December. December sunrise, only the tops of the trees touched with light and frost. Slowly the blue sky appears from the cold morning clouds. Neighbors start their cars. December morning, sunlight through the maple trees, sunlight through the pine. The green redwood trees and the gray clouds, winter sky framed by my window. Only a few clouds, cold clear December morning, pine boughs gently sway. In this winter sky, dark and white clouds commingle, a passing airplane. Neighbor's rooftop frost, upon finishing breakfast, warm sunlight, clear sky. Clear winter morning, the sound of the garbage truck. I have overslept. While reading my mail, the sky turned to chalk dust gray, mid-morning coffee. Steady winter rain. I have to walk carefully on slick wooden decks. Coming and going, the cars in the parking lot, this winter season. The brick-lined alley, edged with shops and small tables and friends conversing. The cool parking lot, even in the bright sunlight, coats and hats and quick. Streak of cold blue sky, between the earth and sky, the bright setting sun. 5 p.m., dusk falls, the cars in the parking lot turn on their headlights. One shaft of sunlight striking the cloud-covered sky, silent winter dusk. Just after sunset, crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, sky from blue to dark. My favorite collection of English language haiku is Richard Wright's collection. It's called Haiku, This Other World. People know Richard Wright? You know who he was? Yes. He was the author of Black Boy and Native Son. And in the early part of the 20th century, he was a civil rights activist. And he, it exhausted him. He had a difficult time politically, and at that time it was put him in a lot of danger. And toward the end of his life, he emigrated to Paris. He was psychologically and politically and physically exhausted. He and his family moved there. And he began writing haiku, and, which surprised everybody, you know, like, because he had written primarily autobiography and political, very strong, intense political work. And the subtitle of this is called Haiku, This Other World. And I like to think that he died, I think, in 63 or 64 or something like that. I like to think that he was talking about, it was, haiku was kind of healing for him. You know, there is this other world. It's not all strife. It's not all contention and that sort of thing. And so I think that, to me, Richard Wright shows how poetry can also heal and broaden one's vision and one's scope of the world. So I have a deep appreciation, and I've learned a great deal from reading Richard Wright's collection. And what I did is I took some of his haiku and I strung them together the way I do. And this is a winter sequence taken from Richard Wright's collection. The drumming of sleet against the roof and windows brightly fans the fire. What stranger is that, walking in the winter rain and looking this way? Seen from a hilltop, shadowy in winter rain, a man and his mule. Past the window pane, a solitary snowflake spins furiously. A brick tenement is receiving furniture in a light snowfall. Just enough of snow for a boy's finger to write his name on the porch. Just enough snow to make the back of each cow vivid in the dusk. Standing patiently, the horse grants the snowflakes a home on his back. I slept so long and sound, but I did not know why until I saw the snow outside. The call of a bird sends a solid cake of snow sliding off a roof. A December wind swept the sky clean of clouds and froze the lake still. In an old woodshed, The long points of icicles are sharpening the wind. The night must be long, for even a yellow moon over fields of snow. The sound of the wind is shaping the long drifts of snow on a mountain ridge. Tossing all day long, the cold sea now sleeps deeply on a bed of stars. Isn't that
beautiful?
Some of his haiku to me are just so striking and so shaped so beautifully.
But that's beautiful how you put it together.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I would encourage people, if you're interested in haiku, if you like haiku poetry, you know, a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll write down their favorites. If when you get enough, put them in a sequence and see, you know, like this is a haiku collage. You know, like and it doesn't have to be a single author. You know, it can be multiple authors. You know, like, so in the Tanka collections in Japan, the sequences are all by different authors. Mm-hmm. You know, like, but you can link them by theme, like winter, you know, winter season, or you can link them by mood, or, you know, or just intuition, what feels, you know, comfortable for you. But I really enjoy doing that with haiku, sort of putting them together like that and creating something. It makes the haiku more personal. You know? So, who here knows what cinquain are? Cinquain is not as well known as haiku, but...
is it like a quatrain?
Exactly, except five. Yes. So, the cinquain were, as far as I've been able to tell, the first systematic response to the American awareness of Japanese forms was the creation of the cinquain by Adelaide Crepcy, who lived from 1878 to 1914. She was very interested in haiku, and she was one of the first Americans who was actually interested in Tanka as well. There wasn't very much available. She didn't know Japanese, but she did know French, and the French had quite a bit translated at that time. And she, in response to the presence of this, she developed a form of poetry which she called a cinquain. And it's five lines, and the syllable count is 2, 4, 6, 8, and 2. You know, like so. And it's become very successful. There are whole magazines devoted to this little form. You know, like, there's one magazine that's been in publication for a long time. It's called Amaze. You know, like, So here, here's a cinquain. Rainfall in the sunlight, a shimmering cascade. We both stand speechless for a few heartbeats. This cinquain is called The Gift. This stone, I remember when you gave it to me. That second date on the beach led to love. Mm. So here's another one a little later in the sequence on love. It's called Long Night. Tears flowed after that night, when words pierced like daggers, words that both of them would regret for years. Mm. So it's one of the reasons I like doing this kind of shaping it to a form is the form has a certain kind of meaning. You know, notice how the cinquain kind of collapses at the end. Well, it doesn't collapse. That's not correct. It cadences. It has a very strong sort of, you know, conclusion with that last two lines.
That's it.
You know, like, yeah. Yeah, and much stronger than haiku, for example, and another one on love. It's called Aftermath. People like you and me, ordinary people, I wonder, are we capable of love? It's called Taking Stock. I've changed. My mind has changed. Likes and dislikes have changed. My physical body has changed. Old age. This one is called The Fragility of Friendship. Moons wane and then return. In spring, grass reappears. But our old friends are gone and don't return.
I like how that curls over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did. That's the appeal of it. It's hard. Cinquains are hard to write. You know, to get the opening two and the closing two is really restricts your possibilities. This one is called Parting. You left, suddenly gone. If I see you again, what will we say to each other? Leaves fall.
A little bit like a haiku, those last two.
Yes, it is. I mean, you can see the influence. Mm-hmm. You can see the influence. Yeah, like she. This one's called Taking a Long Perspective. Nations are unstable. They soon disintegrate. They do not offer us a true refuge. So this is my rewrite of a Buddhist contemplation. The Buddhist contemplation is that nations are unsafe, not stable. And this one is called Propaganda. Slaughter Iraq, destroy the whole country. This is what all our leaders mean by peace. I also want to share just some poems that I've come across recently that I enjoy, you know, like this. This is a poem by Timothy Steele, and it's that was an anti-war poem, and this is an anti-war poem by from his book Toward the Winter Solstice. It's called April 27th, 1937. April 27th, 1937 was the year Franco bombed Guernica, you know, like, and which created an international sensation. It was a big deal at the time. General Ludendorff, 2 years before, had pushed the concept in his Total War. And so it seemed a perfect time to see if one could undermine an enemy by striking its civilian population. This proved a most effective innovation, and as the defenseless ancient Basque town learned, 3/4 of its buildings bombed and burned. Its children and young wives were blown to bits or gunned down when they fled by Messerschmitts. Shot condemnations poured forth from the press, but Franco triumphed, and buoyed by success, the Luftwaffe would similarly slam Warsaw and Coventry and Rotterdam. Berlin cheered these developments, but too can play such games, and usually do, no matter how repellent or how bloody. And Churchill was, as always, a quick study, and would adopt the tactic as his own, sending the RAF to blitz Cologne, dividing better ways to carpet bomb, which later were employed in Vietnam. The Allies, in a show of aerial might, incinerated Dresden in a night that left the good and evil to their fates, while back in the untorched United States, others approved an even darker plan to coax a prompt surrender from Japan. That day in Spain has taught us to our cost that there are lines that never should be crossed. The ignorance of leaders is not bliss if they're intent on tempting nemesis. Each day we rise, and each day life goes on. An author signs beneath a colophon. Trucks carry freight through waves of desert heat. A bat cracks, a crowd rises to its feet. Huge jets lift to the sky, and higher yet, float satellites that serve the internet. But still, despite our cleverness and love, regardless of the past, regardless of the future on which all our hopes are pinned, we'll reap the whirlwind, have sown the wind.
Can you read that last line again?
The very last line?
Yeah, we'll reap.
We'll reap the whirlwind who have sown the wind. That's Ecclesiastes. It's quoting Ecclesiastes. So I'm not going to... I wanted to touch on that given the time and the changes that are going on, but I will not linger there. This is a cinquain called Apparition. I'd swear I saw you there, sitting at the table, but it was just a daydream that took form. A grove of old growth redwoods. Walking in Armstrong Woods brings me a sense of peace, a sense of time that's deeper than a clock. So Armstrong Woods is my favorite place in Sonoma County. So,
it's a wonderful place.
Yeah. So if you haven't been there, I would encourage you to to visit. And this one is called The Perfection of Patience. Redwoods, mysterious, older than this country, silently watch humanity and wait.
What's it called?
What
was the title?
The Perfection of Patience. The title is called Late in the Afternoon When There Were No Customers in the Store. So that's longer than the whole poem.
You sure I wasn't there?
Except for Carl.
That makes such a long title.
Days end, shadows lengthen, the sun and sea embrace, while the stars wait patiently for dusk. And this one is called Song. Incense, cherry blossoms, the colors of autumn. These are the words sung to the song of time. So that's the cinquain. I apologize. I was going to bring some of Adelaide Crepsey's own cinquain, but I didn't flip the book.
How do you spell cinquain?
C-I-N-Q-U-A-I-N. She died in her 30s, and so the output of her poetry is this very, very slender volume. You know, she died of tuberculosis. But she left this form, and people picked it up. I can't remember who it was, but there was this one particular editor who, you know, there's that volume, great American poetry, and she got in there right when that anthology kicked off, it's a wonderful little forum. If any of you are poets, I encourage you to experiment with it. It's surprising what comes up, with it. So on to Tonka. So are people familiar with Tonka here?
Yes.
Who's not?
Yes.
Okay. So Tonka is a Japanese form of poetry. It has a written history of about 1,400 years, going back to the earliest written records. The mythic, the cycle of myths that are foundational for Japanese culture, the Kojiki and the Nihongi, both contain Tonka in them. And the form is 31 syllables in five lines, 5-7-5-7-7. So it's longer than a haiku, almost twice as long as a haiku. They've been writing Tonka ever since. last year, sometime mid-year last year, it suddenly hit me that what we know about Tonka is just like this tiny little sliver of what is available to the Japanese. I mean, the amount that has been translated is a fraction of a fraction. But it has been hugely influential. There were 21 anthologies commissioned by various emperors over the centuries. The most important one I already mentioned is called Kokenshu, sometimes called Kokenwakashu. Waka was the original name for Tonka. Even before that, it was called Uta. So the name has changed, but the form has stayed the same. And that collection, poets for centuries, right down to the modern era, would virtually memorize the Kokenshu. Laura gave a talk last year on the Tonka poet Ren Getsu, wonderful poet. What were her years? 1800s?
She died in 1864.
And she had memorized the Kokenshu. And the Kokenshu is over 1,000 poems. It's about 1,100 poems, something like that. But they would ritually read it every day, until it just became part of the fabric of their poetry. And so in Japan, when poets write Tonka, they often will have allusions to the Kokenshu, what we would think of as very subtle or even elaborate allusions, but they have an assumption that their audience knows this. We used to do things like that in the West, we would make an allusion to a psalm, for example, with just a passing phrase. But nowadays, poets can't assume that their audience has that kind of background. But there are 20 chapters in the Kokenshu, and four of those chapters are devoted to love poems. So there's four sequences of love poems. So So I thought I would read some Tonka on love. And it's that time of year when lilacs bloom everywhere. They're scent on the wind. Where will I find my true love? Perhaps under the lilacs. We stood together on the night when we first met while we were talking. You reached out. You touched my arm, a touch I'll never forget. Where the river ends, where the river meets the sea, where there's wind and sand, I turn to face the sunset and reach out to hold your hand. Bright Jupiter shines under the scimitar moon and diamond dust stars, your hair across your forehead, and your hand upon my thigh. Love is the first glimpse that the world is larger than my concerns and plans, that there exists another who is more than just an other. The Venetian blinds on the window of my room impose a pattern. I thought that you would say no on the night that I proposed. The stars are so bright, the air cold and transparent on this moonless night. Will my love last forever? Will it be gone tomorrow? Each conversation, every time I talk with you, ends in confusion. Am I facing east or west? Is this sunrise or sunset? Each conversation results in confrontation. I think you like it. The blast of a winter storm, meteors burn in the sky. Please don't be distressed. It's become a tangled mess. You don't want me here. Every meeting has its end. Perhaps someday we'll be friends. Slow April morning, amaryllis in the mist. Strange shapes drift and twist. Whose fault was it, our parting? Tentative rays of sunlight. I have to admit, you put one over on me. You sure had me fooled when you said you loved me and you would stay with me till dawn. All interactions with you are confrontations. I am exhausted. Sailing against a strong wind, the boat can't reach the harbor. I don't understand. That's how you respond to me again and again. There are some winter mornings when the fog does not disperse. You are so stubborn. No, not at all, she replies. I can prove I'm right. I'm the voice of sweet reason. Disagreeing is treason. Now we have to part. It didn't start out that way. We did not intend to shatter each other's heart or say the things we did say. Though I try so hard, I can never let you go. Even when we fight, it's just cruel words and cussing and making up feel so right. Will you forgive me? That's all that he requested, but she had moved on. A new experience loomed. She will leave him to his doom. You don't understand. How can I make this clear? Can you disappear and not look back? Don't check in or call me for old time's sake? Love is a strange thing. At first it offers us wings and then eclipses them. What follows is the sharp sting that only love's absence brings. I had no idea that love would demand so much. It's not just a touch, but an abiding presence that once found never leaves us. Standing on this bluff, gazing past the conifers to Sunset Street clouds, I number the days gone by since we last saw each other. I held your pale hand through the months of your fading. I heard your last breath on this anniversary. I sense your presence and love. By the ocean's edge, I wait patiently for more memories of you, riding the incoming waves or the last rays of the sun. I lay down to sleep. Perhaps I'll see you again in this evening's dreams, that I may be glad again until the harsh light of dawn. Sometimes I am sad, and sometimes I am happy. These things come and go. Flowers blossom, petals fall, and love too fades with the dawn. Yesterday I spoke to the memory of you. As I was walking, clouds moved in and covered the last rays of the August sun. Love becomes quiet as the years accumulate. As its roots deepen, a tree becomes more stable, capable of enduring. Yes, I still love you. After all that we've been through, come and take my hand. Roads meander, none are straight. Around that bend lies our fate.
Those are beautiful.
They're so
good. Oh, thank you.
They are.
Thank you. Mm. Now, in the... Did you have a question?
Or just comment. They're beautiful.
Thank you. The... the sequence of love poems in the collections, the Japanese collections, like in the Kokinshu, touches on the moods of love. You know, like it has, and what I recognize, and this is one of the reasons why this collection has had such an influence, it mimics the sequence of spring. You know, how flowers will blossom and then they'll fall. You know, like, and so the sequence of the love poems has that first sort of lift, you know, like, where will I find my true love, you know, like, and then it shows, like, love is part of that natural world, the process of love, you know, like, it's part of that natural world, like spring or autumn, or I think it's a very, there's a lot of insight in just showing love in that way, all those moods, those nuances.
Actually, before I came here, I came from being with a client, and this person has been processing a love story for the last year, and from time to time, and so beautiful for me, because sometimes that can be dramatic.
Yeah.
I mean... And this, listening to it in poetry, it was like she was talking to me. I mean, it was like the stories that have been told were perfectly reflected there, and I just was delighting. Okay. Just hearing, yep, see, this is the story.
This is the story of love. Thank you. Yeah. So, one of my favorite poets is Edmund Spenser. And he was an English poet. I think he was before Shakespeare, but I can't remember. I don't remember whether their lives overlapped, but he was a little before Shakespeare. And he's become, his most famous poem is called The Faerie Queen, which is this huge, it's an, what do you call it, epic poem. But he also wrote a series of love sonnets called Amoretti, which I am very fond of. So here's one. Since I did leave the presence of my love, many long weary days I have outworn, and many nights that slowly seem to move their sad protract from evening until morn. For when as day the heaven doth adorn, I wish that night the noyous day would end. And when as night hath us of light forlorn, I wish the day would shortly reascend. Thus I the time with expectation spend, and feign my grief with changes to beguile, that further seems his term still to extend, and maketh every minute seem a mile. So sorrow still doth seem too long to last, but joyous hours do fly away too fast. The closing couplet?
Yeah.
Yeah, my phone interrupted. Sorry. So sorrow still doth seem too long to last, but joyous hours do fly away too fast. This is probably his most famous one from the Amoretti. One day I wrote her name upon the strand, but came the waves and washed it away. Again I wrote it with a second hand, but came the tide and made my pains his prey. Vain man, said she, that dost in vain assay a mortal thing so to immortalize. For I myself shall like to this decay, and ache my name be wiped out likewise. Not so, quod I, let baser things devise, to die in dust, but you shall live by fame. My verse your virtues rare shall eternize, and in the heavens write your glorious name, where, when as death shall all the world subdue, our love shall live, and later life renew. Spencer was very good. I liked it. No, he's not appreciated enough. So I'm gonna So there's a Korean form, moving on to a Korean form called Sijo. And Sijo is really hard to write. It's three lines, and each line is 14 to 16 syllables long. So it's really long, really long line. It's the most long line form of poetry I know. The French have a line, Alexandrine line, which is 12 syllables long. And that's pretty long. The Sijo is a challenge. The Koreans grow up with it, and so they, it comes to them. But here is an example. Suspended between the rolling ocean and the shifting sky, crossing the Golden Gate Bridge as the September sun slowly sets, the sky turns to dark in the east, shading to blue in the west. So that line, crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, is sprinkled through the, through the book. I have many memories of choices unwisely taken. If only I knew some magic to turn back the tides of time, I would keep the sun from rising or hold the moon in the sky. But Sijo's hard. There are not many Sijo in here. Here is a poem called Sunrise. It's not a Sijo. I stand by the ocean, white sand, almost like dust, in the palm of my hand, and the motion of the pulsating wind, like a remembered melody heard many years ago, the words of the lyrics long gone, only a few fragments now remaining, along with the mood of the song, mingling with the laughter of three children, running directly into the relentless surf, diving into the sunrise of their lives. I like short forms like the cinquain and the haiku and the tanka, but I wanted the I also like long forms like the sonnet. Longer forms. But what I like about tanka especially is how the line length is changing. It goes 5-7-5 and then 7-7. And when you read sequences of them, it's always shifting back and forth. So I worked for quite a while to develop a form that would be longer, almost sonnet-like in length, and I came up with this. And I call it 100 Friends, because it's 100 syllables long. And it's 15 lines, and the structure is, the syllable count is 2, 4, 2, 4, 6, 4, 6, 8, 6, 8, 10, 8, 10, 12, 10. So, yeah, I have a lot of time on my hands. But I found it very congenial. The 100 Friends form refers to my conception of poetry that all the words in a poem the metaphor I use is like they're like a Buddhist sangha, they're like a community of words, and that's what holds a poem together. There's this network of relationships, and so that's why I call it 100 Friends. This one is called Peaceful Passing. Blossoms of the plum tree, thick snow on the branches. A few wisps of steam rise as the warm wind, the first of the season, carries the sound of ice cracking through her still closed window. The light of the first quarter moon and the glow of the angel beside her lights a path in the land of dreams. A land where time ebbs and flows like the tides, where all those she had loved wait patiently for her as her last few breaths quietly subside. Let's see. What can I share with you? This is Dana Gioia. He was a Santa Rosa poet for many, many years. I don't know where he lives now.
He was
in
Washington.
He's been the head of the National Endowment for the Arts under the Bush administration, and under very difficult circumstances, he did very well, in that office. But this book is called Interrogations at Noon, and the poem is called Summer Storm. We stood on the rented patio while the party went on inside. You knew the groom from college. I was a friend of the bride. We hugged the brownstone wall behind us to keep our dress clothes dry and watched the sudden summer storm floodlit against the sky. The rain was like a waterfall of brilliant beaded light. Cool and silent as the stars, the storm hid from the night. To my surprise, you took my arm, a gesture you didn't explain, and we spoke in whispers, as if we too might imitate the rain. Then suddenly the storm receded as swiftly as it came. The doors behind us opened up. The hostess called your name. I watched you merge into the group, aloof and yet polite. We didn't speak another word except to say goodnight. Why does that evening's memory return with this night's storm? A party 20 years ago, its disappointments warm. There are so many might have beens, what ifs, that won't stay buried. Other cities, other jobs, strangers we might have married. And memory insists on pining for places it never went, as if life would be happier just by being different. I think that's a wonderful poem. Mm-hmm. Really, yeah. This one is called Threads. This road through the village connects with other roads, with other villages, with other towns. Trucks and cars and buses constantly moving back and forth, spring, summer, fall, winter, around and around and around. First there is silence, and then there is sound. Coming, going, ebbing, flowing, mountain ranges replaced by the ocean, uncountable stars in celestial motion, drift past my window on a moonless night.
What was the form of that poem?
100 Friends. Richard Denner.
Hey, oh, yes.
This is called Made of Mist, M-A-I-D. Mm-hmm. Okay. For Laura. Something small, the size of a star. Did you make a wish? Far away, far, far away, hard, hard like a star. A mist, a mysterious maid made of mist. A face that enters my dreams and a kiss I miss when awake. Look up, both ways and down. Splendor balanced quietly, her voice a carriage of song. Love sighs, never, forever. The world is small, the heart huge. Love signs, never, forever. Pisces quivers on the horizon. Venus exalted, her dream is deep. She fairly bristles with romance. She walks to work on the stars, a goddess in her constellation. Believe me, the stars are really there. Baffled, I try to walk backwards, see backwards. The leaves lighten and grow visible, light filters down. Feeling is a path, and when the path splits, you must sit and be quiet until the ground trembles. To say I love is not the same as what I feel. The sense is not the sentence, but the words are enough. Would you be the one, the only one near? Were you here, I would fill you with my words. I don't mean to wheedle, flatter, or maneuver. You are in my palm, your presence strong and real. I have to say I miss Richard Denner. He's a wonderful poet. This one is called Night Walk. The moon, the autumn moon, Libra, the waxing moon, a few days short of full, a few thin clouds at the edge of the moon, a plane almost touches its face but slowly curves away, heading towards the coastal city, a gently rising tide fills the harbor, lapping against the wooden pier, the sound of a few seals in the distance. At three in the morning, two strangers appearing, decide to share their interrupted dreams. Here's one from Tom Gunn. He was a Bay Area poet. It's called Lights Among Redwood. And the streams here, ledge to ledge, take care of light. Only to the pale green ribs of young ferns, tangling above the creek's edge, it may sometimes escape, though in quick diffusing patterns. Elsewhere, it has become tone, pure and rarefied, at most a muted dimness colored with moss green, charred gray, leaf brown, calm shadow, then we at least remember to look upward, constant to laws of size, and age the thick forms hold, though gashed through with Indian fires, at once tone is forgotten, we stand and stare, mindless, diminished, at their rosy imminence. Written at Muir Woods. That's some touches on my feelings at Armstrong Woods. Yeah, you know, like has that same kind of feeling for me.
I was thinking of Tamil Pius.
Tamil Pius, yeah. This one is called In Plain View. Acorns from the oak tree, falling in September. I can't count all of them, so numerous. Most of them will not sprout. Conditions have to be just right for something to take root so that it will grow and flourish, basking in the cycle of day and night, sharing a dance with the seasons. Yet in spite of all these contingencies, in the face of all coherency and reason, one can find love blossoming everywhere. That's another 100 Friends. So you guys, this is the premier reading of 100 Friends. And you were there.
You know, it reminds me of birth and some more complexity.
Yeah.
A little more.
Good. This is a poet I just recently discovered. He's quite new, Floyd Skloot. I never heard of him before. I really don't know that much about him. But this poem is called Remission. When all my symptoms melt away like ice that stilled our pond down to its hidden spring, I find myself as though a stranger twice removed from life, believing everything I see will remain as clear as it seems in the shock of morning light. I am out of season, feeling spring when fall sun gleams off frost or an oak leaf, with its stem caught in a strand of spider web wreaths before the pump house door in the swirling wind. The dark edge of hope lurks where time springs shut. No more incandescent visions, only the stark truth of spring in my legs, down a steep trail, and the clear sign of breath when I exhale. Very nice.
Mm-hmm. Like, kind of very useful.
Yeah. This one is called Traces and Memories. Friday, as the sun sets, I think about the week that will come to a close in a few days. Another week will start. But where are all of my old friends, the ones I remember, though sometimes I forget their names? They appear to me in my memory, a touch that dispels loneliness. Perhaps I will see them again. Who knows? Where do moon shadows go when the sun has risen? Plum trees blossoming in the melting snow. Any questions or comments?
Could you just go over again the 100 Friends form?
Yeah. The line?
Just, yeah, the line count.
The line count. I better look
up. You have to write it down.
2, 4, 2, 4, 6, 4, 6, 8, 6, 8, 10, 8, 10, 12, 10.
Very nice. I like
it. Thank you. One more. This is called The Last Summer of Childhood. Dry leaves slowly falling. At night, the rising moon, full in the Libra air. A gentle wind with a hint of moisture blowing through the open window. The sound of my neighbor softly singing a lullaby I heard long ago from my grandmother when we would go visiting during the summer vacation season, a season that felt like it would last forever, ending when the leaves turned to red and gold.
Mm. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Could you talk a little bit about your experience of writing in that form? Do you find it, just if you could talk about just the experience of writing, how your ideas can develop?
I usually start out with a specific image, like dry leaves, you know, like or blossoms of the plum tree, all right? And then I follow it out, you know, like, and I follow the lead of where it will go. And I use a lot of techniques that I learned from Tanka, where lines will pivot, like, so here's an example. As a warm wind, the first of the season, carries the sound of ice cracking through her still closed window, the light of the first quarter moon. So through her still closed window is a pivot line, meaning that at first, through her still closed window is about the sound of the ice cracking, but then it shifts to the moonlight coming through the window, you know, like, and that's a technique I found very valuable in writing this, so that I can take a line and use it to swing to another place, or another swing it to another image, or another place, or even another time. You know, like, does that help? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you say you pick an image like the dry leaves, but did you have the sense that you're writing about the last summer, or did you start?
No.
So you don't know the theme.
I don't know the theme.
You don't start with
theme. I don't start with the theme. I start with an image. You know, like snow on the plum tree. You know, that was the image I started with on that one. Right, and then I follow it out. You know, like, it seems to work for me. You know, like,
Seems like it.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoy working with it. You know, like, I will read one more. It's called Mystical Theology, and there's a whole very large book on this, but this is a poem. So, silence and solitude, these two nourish my soul. They guide me to new realms where self-concern falls easily away. And I begin to realize that existence is vast, that the world is more than human, that the stunning glory of creation is beyond my comprehension, beyond the grasp of my limited mind, passing through the gate of a luminous darkness, darkness within darkness within darkness.
Mm. Mm.
That is beautiful.
Thank you.
Mm.
So I started with the idea of silence and solitude and what it meant to me. You know, like, why do I like it so much when I have times of silence and solitude? What it means to me. You know, like, that was, you know, the image for me, and then it led on from there. In closing, I have to do a Richard Denner close here. Sorry, folks. this is a long poem, but did I lose my place? How terrible! I did have a bookmark in here, but it must have fallen out. Just a moment. So, this may have been the last book Richard published before he left on his 3-year retreat, and he published it with Nancy Doherty, you know, like, and the poem is actually written by the two of them, and the poem is a long one, but I'm only going to read the end, and you'll see why. I consult the stars, look out back at the black, count the numbers needed to win the next lottery, count the days needed to swim to Australia. For making tea, never forget the water. 3 Kaya tea. First steeping, Nirmana Kaya. Second steeping, Sambhogakaya. Third steeping, Dharmakaya. So I just had to end that. So thank you very, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you.